So first of all, I want to thank also the organizer for inviting me. I guess the idea is that I would give you a feeling about what's going on the outskirts of biology and the outskirts that limit with physics in biology. And as it turns out, I hope I will be able to convince you today that molecular biologists have been doing nanoscience for many, many years. Yes, they didn't know it. And what is happening really at the boundary between physics and biology these days is that biophysicists are utilizing all the techniques that have been developed in the last 20 or 30 years by molecular biologists and applying physical ideas and physical approaches to actually characterize biological systems in a way that provides for the first time a more quantitative analysis of this type of systems. So lest I forget, I want to tell you that the work I'm going to show you today, which is really new, has not been published, so this is the first time I talk about it, which is good because I'll be too conscious about giving this talk, and I will not be loading you with nomenclature and funny terms. But what I will show you is that we've been doing actually single molecule studies of how DNA gets packed inside a virus, bacteriophage V29. The work has been done by Sander Tans, Doug Smith, who are two postdocs. Steve Smith is a long-term collaborator, and our collaborators at the University of Minnesota, Shelley Grimes and Dwight Anderson. All right, so first of all, what are bacteriophages? Just to make sure you all are on the same boat here. Bacteriophages are actually viruses that infect bacterial cells. Just like our cells are attacked by mammalian viruses, bacteria also actually are attacked by infectious agents called bacteriophages. Particularly, there is a group of bacteriophages called icosahedral bacteriophages because they, in fact, have the shape of an icosahedron. And these phages have played, of course, a fundamental role in the history of molecular biology from the early studies done on them in the 1940s by Salvador Luria, and are known to be the simplest infectious organisms that we have described. How simple? Well, they basically are made up of two parts. One is a capsid, or an empty protein shell that contains eventually all the genetic material of the phage, namely the DNA of the phage. And then they have a tail that allows them to position themselves on the target host, the bacterium they are going to attack, and in fact, infect the bacterium. Here I'll show you quickly what is the replicative cycle of the bacteriophage, of one of these icosahedral bacteriophages. Here it is, see the icosahedron and the tail, the DNA is inside. The first thing they do is they adsorb themselves on the surface of the bacterium cell, and then somehow they inject the DNA into the bacteria. This injection, this DNA, suddenly takes over all the machinery, all the genetic machinery of the cell, and now it starts directing the expression of early viral proteins so that, for example, a number of DNA polymerases, these are enzymes that copy DNA into DNA, start getting expressed early on, and the result is that the DNA of the phage that has entered now can be multiplied many, many times inside the cell. So now we have many copies of the DNA. Later on, it also directs the synthesis of late viral proteins, which are the proteins that form the capsid that I was telling you. And now, eventually, you have enough of these proteins to form few or many of these mature viruses, which eventually burst the cells, and now the broken, the released virus are ready to actually attack a new cell again. So that's the cycle, the life cycle, the lytic, as it's called, the lytic life cycle of the bacteriophage. And here you see an electron micrograph of these little lunar moduli. This is a very efficient machine, nanomachine, that is actually has posed itself via its filamentous, its tail and its filamentous proteins associated with it on the surface of a bacterium. This is an E. coli bacterium, and is in the process of injecting its DNA to take over the machinery of the cell and actually just reproduce itself. The head of the bacteriophage here is approximately between 800 and 700 angstroms. So we are talking about really a tiny little machine, a nanomachine, capable of actually the only thing it cannot do is reproduce itself, so it needs to actually enter into a host in order to reproduce its DNA, but otherwise it actually can do many things, like actually copy its own machinery once it has some of the material that is inside the cell. Now, early on, one of the questions that was very intriguing to molecular biologists was, how is that this thing actually gets put together inside the cell, inside the whole cell? And at the beginning, the simplest model was the following. Probably what happens is that the DNA condenses, and then the protein binds to the DNA and absorbs around the DNA, and that's how you get a mature viral particle. But about 1975, it was demonstrated that surprisingly, the capsid and all the protein part that you saw that contains the DNA pre-assembles and self-assembles before the DNA gets in, and then the DNA is put inside the head by some unknown mechanism. Well, at that time it was unknown. Now we know that what happens is that the bacteriophage actually has a tiny little motor at the base of the icosahedron before the tail is put in. There is a tiny little motor that works as a molecular machine. Namely, it will consume ATP, which is the energy currency of the cell. It's a molecule with high energy, as you know, and will, apparently, it's believed that it rotates. And as it rotates, it grabs the DNA and packs the DNA inside the head of the virus. Okay? So that is the motivation for the kind of thing that I'm going to be telling you today about. But let me, before I do that, I want to just give you a family picture of some of the icosahedral bacteriophage. Here you have T4, T3, T7, P22, lambda, and the one that we are going to be talking about, which is the short member of the family, P29, which is the one that we have actually been studying. But you see that this is a very conserved design that probably has been conserved throughout evolution because it's a very efficient design. It's the minimal system you can imagine that can sustain, if you want, life. It has a cavity, it contains and protects its DNA inside the cavity, and it has a mechanism to put the DNA in the cavity and to get it out of the cavity. Here is the actual pictures with electron microscopy, and again, you see all the different variety of phages, but the one I want to point out to you is this one, which is Phi-29. This is not on scale now. These are just different scales. But let's look more carefully at the bacteriophage Phi-29 that I'm going to show you. This infects a cell called Bacillus subtilis. And so this host is Bacillus subtilis. And here you see the dimensions. It's about 500 angstroms, the head, along this direction, along the long direction. And it's approximately somewhat about 400 angstroms across. That's where you have to put the DNA. So the volume of the capsid is approximately 56 times 10 to the minus 3 cubic microns. And inside that cavity, it has to put a very long molecule of DNA. In fact, a molecule of DNA that has 19,285 base pairs, which makes up approximately 6.5 microns. So essentially, in putting the DNA inside the head, the motor that is at the base of the bacteriophage head here, or capsid, has to solve the problem of packing the DNA at very high concentrations. How high? Well, if you work with those numbers, you see that the DNA is compacted about 6,000 times inside the bacteriophage head, and the DNA concentration is enormous. It's about 500 milligrams per milliliter. These are concentrations that you cannot obtain DNA in solution. DNA will not actually attain that concentration in solution. So, opposing this packaging, there must be electrostatic repulsion. You remember the DNA is one of the most charged polymers known in nature. Right, it has two electron charges for every 3.4 angstroms along the axis of the molecule. So there is a lot of electrostatic repulsion as you start packing the DNA inside the head. There is also the problem of the bending rigidity of DNA. DNA also has a very high bending rigidity because it has a persistence length of about 500 nanometers, in fact. So there is a mechanical cost. There is, of course, entropy loss, the fact that the molecule likes to be outside rather than actually being a crystalline type of structure inside the head. And ultimately, of course, the fact that you have excluded volume effects, namely the repulsion of the change with itself. This effect is, all of these considerations are supported by the fact that if you actually place these bacteriophages in the presence of high ionic strength, you can actually burst the capsid. And in those conditions, the DNA actually flies apart, and then you get electron micrographs showing what you see here. Essentially, that the DNA was under very high pressures put inside the head, and so it is precisely those pressures that are of interest to us. I will tell you why. How is the DNA packed inside? Well, this is the case, the best studied system is the bacteriophage T7, but it's believed to actually be the same for all the other bacteriophages. And if you look carefully, these are cryo-electron micrographs of the heads of bacteriophage T7. You see that the DNA along the long axis of the capsid, you see that the DNA seems to actually be organized concentrically, so that the DNA essentially is probably packed in an hexagonal lattice type of fashion and at very, very crystalline-like, in crystalline-like form. All right. So you won't be surprised that actually to see that there are many, many components to actually make up a phage. And biology is one of the things physicists always hate about biologists is that, yes. It's sure. So actually, what is thought right now is that in the case of C29, about 75% of the volume is packed, and there is, of course, internal structure of the proteins inside the capsid itself that probably are occupying some of the volume as well. As I was saying here, in order to assemble, to self-assemble the head, you need a number of proteins that actually make up the head and the fibers that you see here that are part of the head. And so these are the names of these things. But the important thing for us is this structure, which is called the prohead, which is empty. At some point, the structure gets filled with DNA, as you can see here. But in order to get the DNA inside, you have to have this particular molecule here, this particular device, which is the motor. This is the packaging motor that puts the DNA inside the head, and that's made up of a protein called GP10, okay? So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that, but eventually, once you have the DNA, of course, you can then put the tail on the end of the head, and you are in business. Now, so the packaging motor is made out of two proteins. The head-tail connector, which I just showed you, is called GP10, that goes for gene product 10, right? Because the DNA of the bacteriophage has so few proteins that you can just call it protein 1, protein 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on. So this is the protein 10, gene product 10. And an ATPase. The ATPase is a molecule, it's a protein that catalyzes the conversion of ATP into ADP and phosphate and the release of energy. And so the connector by itself cannot catalyze that, and it has to associate itself to this GP16 or this ATPase, which actually does that job for it. Okay? So, let me just show you a couple more things about this system. Here is the bacteriophage complete, as seen in the electron micrograph. The DNA is inside. Okay? Now you can actually remove the tail. And so you can just look at heads, proheads of the bacteriophage in the absence of DNA, so there is no DNA here. And it was discovered that this motor that actually packs the DNA is even more complicated because of the following. There is a molecule of RNA, which is another form of nucleic acid, that participates in the process. And what they have done in this experiment is this. They made a cryo-electron micrograph of the phage head with the RNA, then they destroy the RNA by adding an enzyme that chops the RNA, and you see that now we have lost some of this matter here, and so we don't have it here, and when we subtract the two images, we obtain, well, some noise here, but we obtain this structure, which is just made up of RNA. So we know also that there is a ring of RNA that attaches to this mechanism. So I'm just trying to give you, in fact, this is the RNA, it has been studied. Some people say that there are 6 molecules of RNA in the ring, other people say that there are 5. People have not agreed yet on this point. Okay? But what I want to bring about you is that this is a machine that is built up of different parts, each one of which appear to have different functions. And in fact, in the laboratory of José Carrascosa in Madrid, they did the first imaging reconstruction by cryo-electron microscopy of the connector. This is GP10, not GP16, just GP10. And you see that actually it has the shape of this cork that I showed you before. Now we can look at it with a different angle from the top. It has a hole in the middle, which is nice because we hope that the DNA should pass through that hole, in fact. And in fact, this is also done in Carrascosa's laboratory. And last year, the X-ray structure of this connector, of this molecule, actually appeared at 3.5 angstrom resolution. And now we know that it's made up of 12 subunits. Each one of the subunits is shown here. 12 subunits. It has a hole in the middle. Okay, and it has essentially the same structure that is observed, the same general shape that is observed in the electron microscope reconstructions. Okay, so that is the connector, and this is the piece of RNA that apparently is a ring that binds to the bottom of that connector. And here is what we think is happening. That gives you also a sense of the scale. Remember, DNA is approximately 2 nanometers in diameter. DNA. So you see that the hole through which the DNA will pass is approximately 3 nanometers in diameter. And what is believed to happen is that this motor, actually, upon hydrolysis of ATP, starts rotating, and the rotation of the motor actually propels the DNA into the head of the bacteriophage. How? Because it's known that actually these parts of the protein are making very intimate contact with the grooves of the DNA. So one of the proposals is that, in fact, it's working just as a bolt and screw. The bolt rotates and the screw has to actually propagate in the direction into the head in order to actually follow the motion of the protein.
How does DNA find the hole?
Ah, so the finding of the hole, that's a very good question. In fact, biology has an answer for everything, in fact. What it turns out is that the DNA is a protein binds at the end of the DNA, and this protein has a high affinity for this part of the machinery. And so what happens is that the protein with the DNA now with the protein actually hits this, and all of a sudden is now attached there. And then the early stages of what happens afterwards, we don't know yet, but it's targeted via a protein, in fact, called GP3, in fact. All right, so the objectives of the study that I'm going to show you is to characterize the force versus velocity relationship of the motor, because this is maybe a novel motor that couples rotation to translation. We wanted also to determine what is the work done by the motor against all these contribution, electrostatic repulsion, entropy, bending rigidity, etc. Also to characterize what is the dynamics of the motor and the various loads, in other words, characterize the velocity versus force, and determine the stall force, how much force can the motor generate under conditions of ATP hydrolysis, right? And finally, what is the internal pressure that builds inside the head, if there is any.
Is there any estimate for just the electrostatic energy or the elastic energy stored in one of those heads?
Sure. Sure. We can estimate the elastic energy better than the electrostatic. And the reason it's harder to estimate the electrostatic is because, of course, all of this happens in solution in the presence of ions, and therefore there is quite a bit of screening. There is the condensation of counter ions on the surface of, of the DNA, and then there is the bivacuol layers that actually have to be taken into account. So it's harder because, of course, this is not DNA in solution either. It's the DNA into an almost crystalline state. So it's hard to actually estimate the electrostatic, but it's relatively easy to estimate the bending rigidity. So let me just go back and say, well, we've used an actual optical tweezers machine. This is a double beam optical tweezers system that we've built in our laboratory. The actually heart of our system is this microchamber that allows us to actually put single molecules between beads that are chemically modified to attach to the molecules themselves. One of the beads is kept in the trap, the other bead is at the end of a micropipette, which is a very small micropipette that is introduced inside the chamber. Now, here is the geometry of our experiment. Here is the micropipette, the bead, and the other bead at the optical trap. Now, there are two types of experiments that we can do. And so let me just show you the kind of thing that we can get from molecular biology. This is the great thing about the molecular biologists and what they can do. We can actually have beads on the surface of which we have put antibodies that react exclusively with the proteins in the capsid, in the head of the bacteriophage. And then we can have beads, this is the bead that is on the pipette, and then we have a bead that is in the laser trap that is covered with a protein called a streptavidin, which binds with very high affinity to biotin, that's vitamin B12, which we can put at the end of our DNA. So now we can actually tether this particular complex in which the bacteriophage is starting to pack the DNA between the two beads that we control. And then we can actually move this pipette here at our will relative to the position of the optical trap, okay? Now, there are two types of experiments that we can do. One is where we can actually use a feedback and do this experiment at constant force. That means that as the bacteriophage is really in the DNA, right, we move the pipette closer and closer so that the tension at which the motor is doing the work is constant. Say 10 piconewtons. So we maintain the tension throughout the whole packaging at 10 piconewtons. And in the other experiment, there is no feedback. And of course, what happens then is that because the bacteriophage is tied by its back to this bead, right, it must actually pull the bead out of the optical trap. And by doing that, it's actually increasing the load that it feels because it's actually climbing the potential energy curve of the light, right? Okay, so we can actually do these two different types of experiments. Okay, so in the first type of experiments, we actually used very little force because we didn't know how strong the motor was. So only 5 piconewtons of tension are applied to the DNA. And you see several runs in which the tether length is getting shorter with time, as you expect, because the bacteriophage is actually packaging the DNA. But remember, now we are moving the pipette closer and closer. So that's how we determine the tether length, that is getting shorter and shorter with time. When you look at more, this is at low resolution. At high resolution, you see that there is a very interesting dynamic here. There are a number of pauses. The bacteriophage motor pauses every once in a while for 2, 3, 5 seconds, and then for no apparent reason, restarts, starts packaging again, and so on and so forth. Okay, we've seen that the initial packaging rate is about 100 base pairs per second, but then slowly, as the time progresses, it slows down, as you can see here. And these pauses, in fact, we observe tend to happen more often at higher fillings of the heads of the bacteriophage. Now, during a pause, the DNA length remains constant, as you just saw, right? Despite the fact that we are actually pulling with 5 piconewtons. Now, that means that during that time, the motor stays engaged with the DNA. But occasionally, we see that apparently the motor is able to lose grasp of the DNA, and then you see this type of slip, see? You are actually going down, and then all of a sudden, you are pulling, and all of a sudden, a part of the DNA comes out, but then the motor immediately grabs it back and continues packaging. And you see how it grabs it here, and it continues packaging, and then it stops for a while, and then loses grip of the DNA, and then grabs it again and continues packaging. So the motor is capable, in fact, of actually re-grab the DNA when it actually loses its... Yes?
So do you start the experiments with the DNA completely outside of the
chemical? Not completely, actually. Normally it's 20%, 10%, varies from molecule to molecule.
Stable in that that state?
Yes, because yes. So you play a trick. You put a little bit of ATP, and then all the bacteriophages in your solution start packaging, right? Then you add an enormous excess of an ATP that cannot be hydrolyzed. It's an analog. Then that blocks all the ATPases, and then the everything is stopped, and they cannot hydrolyze. And that's how you put them in the system. And then you add ATP again, and then they stop packaging. That's the trick. So here's what happens. Look, when you actually now look at the packaging rate, but not as a function of time, but as a function of how much DNA has got inside, you notice that what here is an average over 8 complexes. This is a single complex. You see it's a lot of noise, a lot of interesting dynamics. Is that below 30% or 40%, there is no dependence on the rate of the packaging on the amount of genome packed. But starting at about 45 or 50%, you start seeing a decrease. And in fact, eventually, even though you are applying just 5 piconewtons of force, which is very little, right? Eventually, you see that the bacteriophage stops. And it stops not when it has packed 100% of the genome. It stops when it has packed 105%. Because we gave it a little bit longer piece of DNA to see if it could actually, we could actually make it. What is what makes it stop was the question. What makes it stop is that it has stuffed itself with DNA. It put 5% more than it should, and eventually stops. And that's why the curve that you see here actually stops at 105%, not 100%. Okay? So the fact that actually there is a decrease in the rate, even though the tension has been maintained at 5 piconewtons, suggests that there is an internal pressure that is building inside the DNA, and we would like to measure that pressure. The problem we have with measuring the pressure is this. We are good at pulling. We are not good at pushing. So how do you measure pressure when you actually are only pulling? Okay, so that was the question that we were trying to solve. What is the pressure, the internal pressure that is being built inside the bacteriophage head, and measure it by pulling, essentially. So in order to do that, what we did is we did the other type of experiment, where we now are not using constant force, but we are allowing the bacteriophage to pull the bead out of the trap, right, and increase the load that it feels along in time. And so in fact here you can see that in the force, in the red curve, you see the force that is actually loading the bacteriophage, right, and you see that it goes between zero all the way to about 55 piconewtons, right, whereas you see what happens to the tether length, which is of course getting smaller and smaller in time. Okay, so you see that eventually, when the bacteriophage gets to about 55 piconewtons, which is an enormous force, this is the largest force ever measured for any molecular motor. This is the strongest motor ever described. Myosin, which is a motor, this is the motor by definition in our muscles, can generate the maximum force between 3 and 5 piconewtons. This can generate a force of about 55 piconewtons, 10 times that. Okay. So now the question is, why is this motor so powerful to actually just put DNA inside the head, right? But you see that actually it stalls about 55 piconewton. It stops about 55 piconewton of force. Okay, so here is the velocity versus force relationship. Here for 3 different bacteriophages at different fillings. And you see that as you start applying tension on the DNA, as it's packing, you are playing essentially a tug of war with this individual motor. You see that the velocity actually decreases, and you can actually stall it eventually at about 55 piconewtons, as I indicated here. Now, notice one thing, and is that as soon as you start applying a little bit of force, you already are starting to decrease the velocity of packaging. That suggests that the mechanical force that you are applying is acting directly on the rate limiting step of the process, right? Because if it would not be acting on the rate limiting step, then it would be insensitive to the mechanical force. So that's one thing we can tell right away just by looking at the form of the curve. But there is another thing that is more interesting about the form of this curve, and is the following. Sometimes we will grab a bacteriophage that had only 1/3 of the DNA packed, and then we will apply the force. And this is what you get here, with 1/3 of the DNA inside the head. You get this curve. And sometimes we will get a bacteriophage, for example, that will have 2/3 of the DNA already packed inside the head. That's this case, right? And then when we look at the force velocity curve, we found that actually we get exactly the same curve, but it's displaced on the left. And in fact, in this particular case, between 1/3 and 2/3, it's displaced by 14 piconewtons. In other words, if we shift this dotted line by 14 piconewtons to the right, we can make the two curves coincide. Okay? So why is it that when it is 2/3 filled, the head, we have to apply 14 piconewtons less in order to stall the motor? Because presumably, there is a force that has built inside, because of the packaging, the pressure, that is acting on the motor. And apparently, that force is additive to the force that we are applying externally when pulling, right? And so, in fact, what that means is that we can estimate what the pressure is that is building inside by actually looking at these curves and doing this for all different fillings. And that's what we did. We did it for all different fillings, and then we were able to estimate the pressure that actually is generated inside the bacteriophage. And so, this is the point. The good overlap observed by shifting one curve relative to the other by 14 piconewtons suggests that the internal and the external forces acting on the motor add. The external and internal forces act also on the same point in the motor, because otherwise you wouldn't get the additivity. Okay, and this point is a slightly different one, just that notice that the curves seem to actually change slope at the end of the at very high force, indicating that probably other processes are becoming rate limiting at that kind of forces, rather than the original one that is actually controlling the process up here at low forces. Okay, so we obtained, first of all, a histogram of the stall forces, which you see the mean is about 55 piconewtons, a very, very powerful motor. And here is how we obtained the internal force. See, we have a plot now of the rate of packaging versus force, and we also have a plot here of the rate of packaging versus the percent of packaging. Right? So we, in principle, can connect these two curves and obtain the force as a function of percent of packaging at very low external force. And from that, we can determine the internal force acting on the motor. And when you obtain that, the internal force acting on the motor, in fact, is zero below 30%, just as we had said at the beginning, and we observed at the beginning, but then after 40%, it starts rising, and it becomes very, very high, and eventually, in fact, attains a value of about 50 piconewtons or so. That's the internal force that is acting on the motor. Okay, that 50 piconewtons acting over the cross-section of a DNA molecule corresponds approximately to a pressure of about 15 megapascals. That's a lot of pressure that has built inside the bacteriophage head due to the fact that the motor has to work against all these, has to pay all these energetic costs to actually put the DNA. And that explains why is that the motor is so powerful, in fact. It has to work against an internal force of 50 piconewtons, so it better be able to generate up to 50 or 55 piconewtons in order to put the DNA inside. So how is this pressure used? Why is that actually the nature has built the system this way? It turns out that we know that there is an ATPase, a mechanism that uses energy in order to put the DNA inside. Now, what is the mechanism by which the DNA puts the bacteriophage puts the DNA inside the host? There is no mechanism. It's purely mechanical. What the bacteriophage has done, is to actually just build the potential energy and contain it in the head, and then when the time comes, it opens the gates and the DNA comes out like a champagne cork, actually, and that's how actually it gets injected. It gets injected by the pressure that has been built inside the head of the bacteriophage. So biologists have been trying. Well, this has been postulated. Of course, you read it in the biology textbooks, but it is important to be able to measure actually these numbers, because then you can actually, in fact, tell there is a pressure and is this much, right? Okay, so we have obtained all kinds of other interesting data. Work done to package the DNA, for example, is this amount of work in joules. You won't be surprised that these numbers are so small, because it's a single molecule after all. That's equivalent to about 8 × 10⁴ piconewton nanometer. KT, I remind you, is 4 piconewton nanometer. The available energy per ATP is about 120 piconewton nanometer, and the maximum work done per ATP is about 37 piconewton nanometer, when we assume that the step size is 2 base pairs, which is, comes from some molecular biology study previously. That suggests that the, this motor is working with an efficiency, minimal efficiency of about 30%. So it's a pretty respectable motor engine. So let me conclude by saying that we've characterized a motor that we think is a novel type of motor. We are actually doing experiments to try to demonstrate that the motor rotates. And the way we are doing that is by labeling with a fluorophore one spot in the motor and then looking at the depolarization of the fluorophore to see if, in fact, that during packaging under the microscope, you see the change in polarization corresponding to the rotation of the bacteriophage. The mean velocity is about 100 base pairs per second. That's a lot. There are fluctuations in velocity, pulses, slips. That's not surprising. These are stochastic machines. They work barely above the KT of energy, as you know, and so therefore they are subjected to large fluctuations. And in fact, fluctuations may be part of the mechanism by which they actually function. So there is a very interesting, a wealth of interesting theoretical ideas that actually could go into analyzing these complex systems. How is that they work? Do they work as Brownian ratchets moving over potential surfaces and actually using partly chemical energy, partly noise, etc.? The stall force is 55 piconewtons, and the internal pressure that is measured by in this experiment due to the DNA confinement increases in a nonlinear fashion with filling and attains this value, and we believe that that is the pressure that is used in order to inject the DNA inside the host. So let me stop here, and thank you very much.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I find this absolutely fascinating. And to a conference that tells those of us who come from the physics side that nature has anticipated some of what we are trying to do and gives a wonderful example of what we might want to achieve in the future. So, this is up for questions.
Yeah, can you comment on your the original hypothesis about the way the motor works, about rotating around this whole screw idea?
Yes.
It seems like that's a lot of force. I don't know what the deformability of DNA is, but if you have only one thread on that one position as the mechanism for imparting that much force, you'd think that the DNA would just somehow get deformed.
Right. I personally don't like the model, that model. And in fact, this is why we need more physicists working in biology, because the model was proposed by the people that solved the X-ray structure in the Nature paper last December. And I think it's ludicrous. I think, just like you say, the compliance in the protein and the DNA is such that it will never work. In fact, there are other models that you can imagine where actually the idea of the rotation will still give rise to that. For example, the electrostatic repulsion between the motor and the DNA could actually lead to the rotation and the propulsion of the DNA without actually having to go into such a mechanical type of design. So there are several competing models, but most of them involve rotation. And the reason is that the chemistry that has been determined by the X-ray crystallography indicates that the point of contact between the capsid and the motor is made up of amino acids, which are all very greasy, but do not They are greasy hydrophobic amino acids around in the outer layer in the capsid, and then all hydrophilic amino acids in the part of the motor, indicating that essentially it's providing the kind of lubrication basically that would be required for rotation. And there is one other example where actually this has been proposed, which is the case of ATP synthase, the enzyme that synthesizes ATP in our mitochondria. And in fact, it has been demonstrated by optical microscopy that it rotates. It rotates very, very fast, and it has exactly the same type of lubrication. So in fact, this is another example of how biological systems actually use all the tricks. I mean, literally all the tricks. They would actually put hydrophilic against hydrophobic in order to ensure minimal interaction, for example, that's what is desirable, and so on and so forth.
I have two questions. Mm-hmm. First is simple.
How long does it take? You said a velocity 100 base pairs per second. How long is the strand and how long does it take?
It's about 20,000 base pairs, right? So the bacteriophage will pack the DNA within a minute normally. And it is that because it oftentimes stops. And we don't understand yet the dynamics of the stopping. It's pulling and then all of a sudden stops and stays there for 5, sometimes 10, sometimes 15 minutes, seconds. And then all of a sudden it starts again. One possibility is that the DNA inside the head is actually has to rearrange itself in order to pack correctly, and that temporarily the pressure shoots above the force of, shoots above 50 piconewtons. That stalls the motor. Once the DNA accommodates, then the bacteriophage motor can continue packaging.
The other thing I was going to ask is, you didn't say anything about the mechanism of release. And is there anything postulated?
Well, the mechanism of release of the DNA. Yeah. So there is no mechanism known that actually releases the DNA. So most people assume that somehow the DNA must be just ejected passively. The hypothesis had in the biological community had gone in two different groups. People said maybe it's using the pressure, which is what we have found, and the alternative was that the DNA will eventually go out because it will increase its entropy, and so it would rather go and be free.
The trigger.
The trigger probably is the moment in which the bacteriophage poses itself through the tail into the surface of the bacterium, and then some signal will actually be communicated. There is a conformational change that can be seen in the tail and in the electron micrographs that apparently opens the gates of the head, and that actually is what allows the DNA to. So it's probably through the tail interaction.
The motor has to rotate in one direction as it starts it.
Yes.
Can I assume that when it emits the DNA out, the ratchet mechanism or whatever it is broken?
Well, we don't know because nobody has actually studied the. Another way to put that is to say that is the following. If you were to give the motor ADP and phosphate, and you would actually pull, could you synthesize ATP? Could you reverse the motor? Could you make the motor go up in the opposite direction and actually convert it into a machine that synthesizes ATP rather than an ATPase that consumes ATP? And the answer is we don't know yet, but this is one of the experiments we want to do, to essentially reverse the chemistry, put the chemistry in conditions in which by doing mechanical force, we may be able to actually synthesize ATP. And if we synthesize ATP, that will be clear that whatever was happening in one direction must be happening in the opposite direction, because you have to sort of be microscopically reversible in that case.
Are there models of how the ATP energy is transformed into the mechanical motion?
Yes, not for this motor, unfortunately. This motor, this is one case where we've been able to actually make the single molecule measurement before too many models have been built in the literature. But there are not no models, because you notice that I show you the structure of the connector of the actual motor, but I didn't show you where the ATPase goes. That's still a mystery. We don't know. The structure that has been solved doesn't include the ATPase. So probably the ATPase consumes energy, catalyzes the reaction, releases the ATP and ADP, undergoes a conformational change that actually leads to the rotation of the motor.
Same question.
You showed the extreme regularity of the packing of the DNA inside. Is anything known about the mechanism and how that regularity is achieved?
No. In fact, we don't know how is that. In fact, that's a very good question, right? You imagine putting this, having an aperture, and then putting something, a rope with some bending rigidity as DNA is, and what would you expect will happen if you just go and push it this way, right? Well, you have a mess in principle. Somehow it's not a mess, because otherwise only a few percentage of the time the DNA will end up packaging correctly inside the head. So we don't understand how is the mechanism by which it actually packs inside. But here is an experiment that we are planning to do that may give us some information about what happens as the process occurs. The DNA apparently is coiling inside the head, right? Because the DNA is coiling, what it's doing is we are supercoiling the DNA, right? And that means that the DNA outside has to rotate in order not to build torsional strain. Imagine that I would actually hold the DNA from outside and not let it rotate. As the thing goes in, it will start building torsional strain. So the DNA has to rotate. So the idea is to actually do the same experiment, but put a tiny little bead on the side of the DNA to see the rotation of the outside DNA, and then measure the number of turns as a function of the packaging. And in that way, sort of estimate how regular is the process of coiling inside the head, as what is happening inside the head by looking at the DNA outside the head. That is the idea.
That motor, of course, applies a torque on the DNA.
Apparently, it has to do that.
And you see, I do this every weekend with my garden hose. I try to put the garden hose into a bucket, and I know if I simply feed it linearly, it doesn't work. But if I twist it, it coils up nicely.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No. It is. These things are extremely mechanical, and that's one of the nice things about these models, that actually you can go with all your prejudices of physics, and usually it works. Actually, yes.
Do you know how fast it comes out biologically? I mean, so you said the mechanism, but just the rate.
The rate is even faster. Right. It's almost supersonic. For coming out, it's known to be actually extremely fast. It happens.
So there's two questions. I mean, doesn't that comment a little bit on the discussion you're having before about the reversal of the going in process?
Right.
It seems very likely. The other thing is, you'd expect some knots to form in there, wouldn't you? I mean, my God, it's shooting out like a champagne cork, some weird
knots. DNA will form knots in solution, but the rule of thumb, people have actually done Monte Carlo calculations on DNA. One advantage of DNA is that it's extremely self-repulsive chain. So DNA doesn't like to do this too much. That's why the motor has to do so much work, because it's getting the DNA very oppressed. So it doesn't really like to do this. Nothing is not so simple. In fact, the cell has developed enzymes whose function is to knot the DNA in order to condense it so that it is in the right place, so that when the cell divides, 50% of the DNA goes one way and 50% goes to the other daughter cell. So I think that I seem to remember that the probability of a knot is close to one for a DNA of about 50,000 base pairs. So and usually the cell has ways of dealing with knots very 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 efficiently, but I don't think that there is too much problem with knotting with a piece of DNA of 20,000 base pairs like this.
Well, I'm afraid our time is up. At least the official part is up. So I'm sure there will be lots of opportunity for private discussions.